Hello and welcome to another episode of My Opinion Means Nothing. Today on the show I am joined by Tommy Evans, Nassim Asghari, and do you want to speak?
Oh no, I didn't think I was, bro.
No, you can, you can. It's up to you, bro.
It's not working.
You have opinions too, bro.
Graham Jordan.
Graham Jordan, man. Welcome. How's everyone doing?
I'm good.
Blessed, man. Blessed.
Yeah, that's good. Everyone had a good day, I'm sure.
Productive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Productive. Okay. It's worked out very interesting. Maybe that would be a good start to our discussion.
Yeah, sure, why not?
So today I was doing the do around my flat and then I get a message from my esteemed colleague from Canada who is sat adjacent to me now, a big smile on her face, saying that she's in the UK and that she was actually coming to this locality. Obviously we're in the Labrador vicinity at the moment. Obviously I'm sure listeners know the history of the past year and a half with Grenfell, what's been going on. So I was saying to our respected sister that, well, yeah, this is where I live, man, and we need to connect, you know what I mean? But I had to go and get some acupuncture. So I had to dash out to Holloway Road, which intriguingly enough is where our esteemed and respected host has just travelled from.
Exactly where I just come from, all right.
And then when I came back from Holloway Road, I managed to track down my esteemed colleagues from Canada and deposit them here, and then here we are. So.
Yeah.
It's there we
great
go.
Start. Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, yeah. Serendipitous.
Yeah.
Serendipitous. There you go.
What do you guys know about the 11/11 thing? Do you know guys know about 11/11?
Yeah, it's a rich cross upon your hands. I don't know.
Okay, cool. Like,
I don't know if I know.
So like, I've been seeing 11/11 a lot, like on Times and stuff like that.
I think I know what you're getting at.
But no, it's so weird. It's like, 0111, I see all the time. It's crazy. But it's the first time I noticed there was some guy, some poet was telling me about event 11/11. You need to look out for it. But the actual definition of it, I'll just quickly find it. It's just a random thing that popped into my head.
Make a wish thing?
No, it's like...
Is it on that topic of being serendipitous?
Yeah, kind of that kind of thing.
Okay. I think my friend had something where it was 1624 and it had a similar acute, profound meaning for her, but...
So basically, there's thoughts behind, if you see 11/11, it means you're paying attention to the thoughts as an opportunity, a portal is opening up for you.
Wow.
So it's basically like the things that you're thinking about are coming into fruition.
Wow. Okay. This happens to me very often, actually. There's so many times where I'm thinking of certain people and I don't get the time to reach out to them, for example, and they're the ones who reach out to me. And I'm like, wow, it's wavelengths. It's like frequencies connecting even without the literal connections. Yes.
So be on the lookout for it. If you ever see it, that's what it means. It's one of the reasons for it. So just... And deja vu, I had that again today as well. I have deja vu a lot. It's very recently in my adult life. It's mainly been like dreams that I had when I was really young and I was sick and I had no idea what they meant. I was in places, I was with people and I had no idea who they were. Now in my adult life, I'm being in situations and I'm just like, shit, I've been here before. I literally physically been here and I didn't know who the person was at the time, but now it's just... Oh, it's crazy. I had it today when I was at Magdalena's house and I was talking to her. That was the deja vu moment I had. It was crazy.
Yeah. It's like, I can definitely still speak to that for sure. Like, so many times when I've woken up in almost like a similar, even here, we had a little place off of Slade Green and we're waking up and it's so similar to like a condo apartment that that's like one of the students' friends that we're at. So I'm waking up, I'm like, I'm not even, like, I've either been here before or I'm right back at home. I haven't left anywhere, right? So it's like my position's changed, but my mind's still exactly where it was. So it's caught up to where I am now, right?
Yeah.
So that stuff right there, that's like, I wake up, look over to see him, like, hey, are we done this? Yeah, wake up tomorrow or wake up yesterday? But I just get up now.
That's so trippy.
I don't know. I like to look at it as like you're heading in the right direction if you kind of relive a moment that you've been to before and you didn't know where you were before and you now know where you are. It's kind of...
I think that more like in daydreams. I call daydream about being in a place or going to a place over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And then I end up being there. Like I daydream about going to Japan. Like when I was a kid, like long. Not anything specific about it, right? But then I'm going to work at a district school board. Some friends and tell me that they lost someone to go on a trip with them, and then I get to go on that trip. And this is something I've been daydreaming about since like young. But there's no action, no intent of actually putting that into motion. But then somehow now I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm like, did I daydream that into existence?
Yeah. So, but like, that's the thing. The speaking of things into existence and the manifestation of things through words and through thoughts, which just shows how powerful words or thoughts,
active thoughts
can be. I feel like for myself, it goes back to what you said. There are certain parts of my childhood that I had forgotten about, and my mind had just blocked, and I had no stories or collections of. But recently, actually, in the past few years, just through very small things, those memories of me when I was back home in Iran as like a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, or like different moments in my life as a child are reoccurring through very small triggers of like either smells or things to see.
Future tripping.
But it makes me wonder if I accidentally blocked those very certain things and they're resurfacing now, or if it's just, you know, that's the
like
way it is.
Like a human defense mechanism.
Exactly. Actually, I was listening to a podcast about a month ago whilst I was in the gym. So I do a lot of multitasking. So I'll be like exercising and listening to a podcast or rehearsing my lyrics.
That's how it goes.
Yeah, I have to. And it was a Swiss or Czech scientist. I can't remember his name, but I'll get the deets and whatnot. And he did a lot of research over the past 50, 60 years. And sort of regression going back to childhood and actually to the moment of birth, and saying how birth actually leaves an imprint on your consciousness. And a lot of the issues that we may face are all these sort of like the traumas of birth that are so buried so deep, because obviously as a baby there's no way you can process that. But I'll get the link for the podcast.
That sounds great. Remember that first life you get as a kid? You're like, no more of that.
This is it, man. So you don't know what has happened in your formative years and how it could impact you,
how it's made you.
That's definitely true. So
what about like past lives? Do you believe in that? Or because I don't know, if we're all energy and nothing is lost in the universe when something dies, everything is recycled, then technically if Joan of Arc, say, died in the soil and then a cow ate the grass and that grass and that cow became meat and it was eaten by a human that then, do you know what I mean? So like, could that mean that someone's life force could be in you that could create a past life, or maybe you lived a life before, or I don't know.
Would there be too much filters, I guess, between that and that? They'd be deluded enough that maybe you just remember cow's life?
Yeah.
not to take away from that, but like, I feel, it almost feels very, I feel like it'd have to be one-to-one.
Yeah.
Believe more closely than that. But definitely those sort of energies, I think it influence attitudes in a person within a point of time.
Yeah.
That's a very a segment. I mean, maybe there's like a shelf life to it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I feel like maybe that.
Yeah.
You know? So then when you ask for the fresher, then you do feel it more.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, I had that cow fresh. That fresh got killed, blessed, oh my God, you know? then maybe you feel that more. But yeah, energy, like, yeah, energy is decay.
Yeah.
Everything decays over time, right? So I feel like something like that could be a time thing more than an energy. How quickly can I get to that energy before life gets to it?
Yeah.
Death gets to it.
I remember a Raskas lyric, which is based off Einstein, I think, but matter can't be created or destroyed, it just changes shape. Yeah. What it means, I don't know, it sounded dope though.
It does sound
dope. I'm being a bit facetious, but I don't know. I mean, I think with maturity, one thing that I found is that there are more shades of grey and nuances and subtleties. So when I was younger, I still consider myself very young. But when I was younger, the world was probably a lot more black and white, and I dealt in truth and falsehood as very distinct binaries.
Yeah.
Whereas now, it's a lot more complex.
So yeah. It's so amazing that you say that, because growing up, in the past few years, and I was just speaking to Graham about this the other day, actually, even based on my language, there was a friend who would always call me out and be like, you use absolutes too often.
Wow.
You know? And recently, in the past couple of years, as I've been, I just turned 21, not like in the past year. And so I'm at the tiptoes of adulting and actually like living on my own and starting my future and continuing my career in the direction I want to go in and trying to set my vision into concrete words or actions. But I realized, I've been realizing that, yeah, nothing is really particularly absolute. Like, gray matter is...
That's brain matter.
It's, yeah, yeah. And I've realized that everything is so nuanced, and I can't speak in absolutes, even for myself, yep. because I can't say of something, for example, that I won't do, because, first of all, how am I to predict the future?
Yep. Yeah.
And also recognizing that the reason why people do things they do a lot of time is because of their nuanced pasts. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how am I even setting that absolute standard or that absolute timeline when I don't know what the future is holding and I don't know what led other people to those futures? Because of their past that I don't know about, and vice versa. So I've really been, what Brother Tommy said, I've really been feeling that as I'm growing more into myself and growing more into the world, and it's scary. Yeah. It's scary to be like, oh shoot, this one answer, this one thing does not actually have one answer. Yeah. And, but even, like, I mean, the religion or the path I follow, it even says there's multiple ways to the truth, you know, or at least I believe that in so many different ways to what goodness could be, what truth can be. And
I think your answer is very mature and compassionate and beautiful. as an addendum, there's no but. I think it's beautiful and it's part of that maturing process. I think that we all go through. And there can be something very comforting and warm and secure about having a singular understanding of what truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be somewhat disorientating, challenging, scary even when you find something that was black and white, absolute truth. Oh, maybe there are various angles and sides and vertices to this dodecahedron.
Precisely.
There's a line in Revenge of the Sith, the third Star Wars film, in which
you
can always
dump on the tree so badly. Come on, 2003, everything was bad then. No,
it's all good. One can always extract gems of wisdom from the Star Wars saga. So, Obi-Wan Kenobi is confronting Anakin, who has been lured, seduced, tempted to the dark side of the Force by Darth Sidious, the Emperor. And Anakin says to Obi-Wan Kenobi, in a sort of echo of the political climate at the time, you're either with me or against me. Quite a clunky analogy, but you know, it served its purpose in the film. And Obi-Wan Kenobi says, only a Sith deals in absolutes, but then someone rightly pointed out, well, that's an absolute statement in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Catch
22, catch ourselves.
But I suppose we're all on a journey of, well, not everyone. I'm on a journey of truth seeking. There's even a line in my book, I have a nice segue there, Medusa Warrior, which is the title of the book, and the poem is From the Wounds of Warriors. We crave paradise and the afterlife, give us comforting answers. I pose challenging questions. I'm the son of my father. Contrarian spirit, royal lineage, born to commoners from the wombs of warriors, etc., etc. So my dad has quite an obstreperous disposition at times, in that he isn't shy of not fitting in.
Okay.
So perhaps nature, nurture, that's another discussion itself. You know, maybe I've been socialized or I've genetically inherited that quality. So I've got that awkwardness. Maybe that's not the best word, but you know, I feel comfortable in posing questions, being curious, inquisitive, and not shy to ask questions and not shy to accept that I might not get answers to those questions. But I also, in those lines in the poem, trying to acknowledge that a lot of people do want something that gives them a purpose, a focus, a place in life, and answers their questions, that gives them a source of strength.
Point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then they find solidarity with others who share their worldview. So I think part of that growth is being able to step out of that bubble, being confident in your own philosophy or beliefs or values or ethics, encountering and interacting with people who have a different worldview from your own, learning from them, respecting that view, interacting with them in terms of, you know, compassion, love, respect, working towards common goals, or saying, all right, well, we can agree to disagree on this and agree on this and work for the common good. Maybe that's a very idealistic answer.
It's very well rounded.
Importance of asking. That's one thing my mom would always tell me. Like, ask questions instead of making assumptions. And listen.
Big up to mom.
And listening to me is the biggest part of growth. Observing is the biggest part of actually growing. And there is a difference between just changing as a person, but and growing as a person. You know. And that's exactly what you speak on, and I think we that is the ways in which we need to tread in, you know, as long as the focal point is set and we know, or we're trying to seek ourselves in the process, seeking the truth won't be as difficult.
Big up to your mom. My tutor at Outpod said something similar. He said the only stupid question is the unasked question.
That's what my mom
said. But for me, growing up,
shut up and hold the flashlight.
For me, growing up, I was timid in a lot of ways, or my voice, I felt like, was shut down a lot of times, and that might have been because I was the only Iranian kid or the only Muslim kid a lot of times. So I felt enclosed within myself, and my voice wasn't heard enough. Which is probably why I turned to poetry and why I felt like I needed to let it out in one way or another.
That's a neat segue. People, get her book.
I can't see it, but
I'm holding it. What was swept under the Persian rug?
Nassim
Chikshari. Fresh off the print.
200 and...
something pages.
15, 16, 17 pages. Yeah. Beautiful art. Edited by Jamila. Aladina.
Illustrations by Naeem Askari, who is my big brother.
There you go.
Bom, 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 bom.
That was a neat segue and shameless branding, marketing.
Thank you. For that.
We don't do no one else.
Yeah, exactly.
So now let me talk about myself.
What's happening in the world, guys?
Where do we start?
Okay, so the first article that I found. Just found it funny that today is the UK supermoon.
Oh, I think I heard something about it.
So basically, it's the fact that it's called the supermoon because it's really close. It's in the orbit that it does around the Earth. It's on its closest.
Toronto just had ours. A month or two ago. Yeah, I believe so.
But see, the funny thing of the article was that most of the UK won't be able to see the supermoon. Because No, it's just the forecast of it just being too cloudy.
That's very atypical British, isn't it?
Like, when I came here, I packed strictly sweaters and hoodies because I wasn't checking for the sun. Like,
and Doc Martens.
Yeah. So one time, I can't even rock my Docs in Canada because everything's salted, all the roads and iced up. It's gross. So I knew I'm coming here, I'm rocking my Docs. I'm my hoodie, and I'm rocking like knitwear. I'm stepping out nice. But I get here, and it's warm. I'm like,
I know, right?
Man.
We're in a mini heat wave at the moment. By February standards.
But saying that, this week is meant to be one of the hottest days in February. Since 1998, it's gonna
be. Dude, that's so deep you said that because I remember that February of 1998. I was just. Obviously, I was about 3 or 4
that's
at the time.
That's the year after I was born.
I was young.
Yeah, sorry.
But when we were talking about warm Februarys, I was like, I remember that February 1998 was so hot. Literally just going around in t-shirts.
Wow.
There we go.
So it's going to be 19 degrees at some point this week.
Oh my God, I hope we're here for that. We're leaving this Friday. Nice. Toronto right now is, or has been, and is... It's like it fluctuates in very weird ways, and that just shows that humans are,
we say humans like it sounds like an individual.
Massive corporations
like
and companies
and all these dudes like that.
Precisely.
Those are the ones who hold the majority of the problem.
Yeah.
And all the people are like, no man, if you start wearing recycled rubbish rightly,
if you start using a paper straw instead of
guys, yeah, the guys will go cut down half of this or pump out half of that and then be like, well, it can't be us. Like, right? Like, nah bro, like that's the worst, man.
It's true.
But yeah, what's that moon supposed to do your tides and stuff? And like to the people even, like 70% water is us, right?
So, yeah, that's where the word lunatic comes from, isn't it? Yeah. So lunatic is
that we stare the sun too, moon too long.
The idea I think was in the Victorian times is that the moon had an influence on people's mental health and well-being, and that people who had certain issues on that front, it was more pronounced times of
full moon. La lune is the moon in French. Lune is French for moon. And one thing that always mesmerizes me is I've heard in certain Islamic traditions from certain schools of thought that the placement of the stars affects you at birth. And considering we've had this conversation, like you say, considering that humans are we're more than 70% water.
Yeah.
And if the moon has the ability to shift the tides of the seas and the oceans, and if we're reminiscent of the earth itself, meaning we are made of dust, we are made of clay, then who are we to think that it doesn't affect us in the same magnanimous ways?
I mean, you know? They say things like, if you talk to water badly, it'll taste worse than if you talk to water nicely. So it's a proven fact. Like, the same with plants, and if you speak nicely, it promotes good growth. So
there's so much we just don't know, man.
Yeah, I know, but like, how many times have you done studies on that? Like, how many
accurate.
I feel like it's been enough times that like we can actually kind
of
say, like, all right, well,
it's facts.
Talk shit.
Yeah,
bad stuff's gonna happen, right? Yeah. And it's just something that's like it goes back into what you put in the atmosphere can actually happen, right? That's a reality that you're talking and daydreaming, you know. Ends up happening, here you are, right? The reality that you compress over yourself, whether it's like negative or even then, still, I believe also in music as well too.
Yeah.
Like, that's just for me personally. Like, I like to have a lot of like upbeat, happy, like reminiscent stuff. Something's gonna keep me in a good mood or a good aura sort of around me, right? Just because one, I don't want it now. Two, I got too much bad shit happened to me back in the day for me to try to put on some sad side and stuff, remember it.
Yeah.
And like, it's just not, I just don't feel it's profitable, you know, right? But I know like other people do for other reasons, but yeah, it just goes back to cultivating your space, your personal space. When you interact that with other people, you know, you bring that with you, so then, oh, this guy's so charismatic, yo, he's gotta be cultivating that every single day. And that's just not like with how he thinks, how he speaks, it's actually the things that he carries around with him, you know?
Yeah.
Whether that's like, maybe some stone on your hand, or like, you know, maybe some ideas in your head, music in your ears, right? It's gonna be more you put in, more you spit out.
Yeah, true.
Something like that. Sort of.
What we have in life is our stories.
That's a, that sounds like a book title, brother. I like that. All we have in life is stories.
What we love have in life is our stories.
Yeah, that's even more beautiful. I really love astrophysics to sort of segue from what we're on. For me, astrophysics is a sole area of my life where there's a magic to it. So I'm a student of deliberate practice, as popularized by Malcolm Gladwell in Outliers.
Yes.
Canada.
Yes.
Great export, Mr. Gladwell. and I obviously his Caribbean ancestry, as I'm British ancestry, but yeah, he holds it down
phenomenal.
From there. And he popularized the work of a Scandinavian scientist called Anders Ericsson, who has a brilliant book called Peak, which talks about deliberate practice and that notion that to achieve mastery of any field of endeavor, you have to apply yourself diligently to the intention that you have and put in a certain amount of practice over many years. And Anders Ericsson is quite hardcore in that he, and this is not to misrepresent his work, but he's a sort of foregrounds work ethic over talent, to the point where he's saying almost that talent is almost a myth, if you see what I mean. It is about work, to develop a skill set that becomes your talent. So for me, I'm very much a disciple of that belief and that philosophy. And having studied it, I sort of, it removes some of the illusion, shall we say, because you see the grit behind the glitz. But for me, the one area of my interest where that magic remains is astrophysics, because it's just so beyond my comprehension. When you study the universe and just see how vast it is and like how perfect it is,
and you're like, humbled by it, you know.
Totally.
And for me, actually, I that was a field I wanted to go into, astronomy specifically. But then I realized I'm an artist and I'm horrible at math, and you really need math to go forward with that.
Yeah, I feel your pain.
But it will forever like enlighten you, even to realize how small you are in relation to, but also how huge you are in relation to. It's a beautiful balance.
That's mad.
I have a friend that one of his friends uses astrology to trade stocks.
Yeah, you know what? They use monkeys sometimes, and then he went up to. Like, they use like a same sort of like thing. They use like a chimp to like play the stocks.
Yeah,
that's crazy. You play the stocks.
Yeah. So like, from, yeah, if certain crops are growing a certain way, then he'll invest his money in a certain stock, and it works.
Wow! I mean, even so many traditions, like so many. Religions and indigenous practices are based on the earth and the universe, you know? And it's just like when I feel like when we sway from that and internalize the artificial in us, there's a part of us that craves to go back to what our body knows to be the organic nature of our being as well. That makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Very eloquently articulated.
But
it's going to be a dope episode to listen.
Thank you for having. I wasn't even...
There you go.
There was, like, I had no idea this would even be happening.
Serendipitous.
Serendipitous. That's, I'm reading a book called Spiritual Serendipity.
Okay.
By... The last name is Air. But he... It's so amazing. He talks about this, the word serendipity in itself and the practice of serendipity, and basically realizing that self, he mentions how self-help is not really a concept, because ultimately, like, we need something or other things in order to help ourselves. So that is not a individual thing. He speaks on that. He speaks on allowing essentially the tides or the waves to guide you and taking you in the directions that the world is meant to lead you in. And the origin of that word came from a guy named, his first name is Horace. I could look it up. That is your dad's name, yeah. But basically, Serendip used to be the name of Sri Lanka at some point.
Okay.
So it was first Ceylon. It was first Serendip and then Ceylon, or the other way around, and then it became Sri Lanka. But at that time, all the empires and all that region was connected. So he had read a Persian fable by the name of the Three Princes. And it's these princes who their father sets them out on this journey to find this specific thing to stop the curse that's been put on the waters around the area. And the way they move in order to reach that mission is through taking their time and listening and observing and taking everything around them and absorbing it in order to reach that final way, you know, to realize that we are not the only ones who impact our stories. There's something greater than, and whether that be something in the universe, whether that be the energies of everyone else colliding at the same time, or whether that be God, if you believe in God. And it's actually a very beautiful book so far.
I have to check it out.
I'm still just reading into it, but I'm coming back to it after starting it when I was like 15. Yeah. I started reading it when I was 15, and then I remember putting it down, and that, it's still been on my bookshelf, so I was like, okay, this is it. And it's actually really good so far. Yeah, cool. Serendipity.
Okay, I just thought this was weird, just in general, but there's a, so the, I probably better telling the whole story. So these two friends, British guys, from Newcastle, they went away to Prague.
I've seen that title and I'm like, this is not played.
Oh wow.
So they went to Prague. I'm the only one who actually doesn't know what's going on right now.
So they went to Prague and like somehow their passports got switched. And one guy flies back into the UK using his friend's passport, not got stopped once. He didn't even realize himself until he got home and checked. He was like, oh,
that's not
my passport.
What?
No one stopped him. They went from Prague via Amsterdam. No one stopped him at Amsterdam. No one stopped him at the UK border. He said, it says in here, Amsterdam, do you know they have like the thing?
Yes.
They said it didn't read it properly on the screen thing. He went over to a human. The human just flagged him through. They didn't even check the passport.
Yeah, but it's they barely do.
It's like, or they how you look like your much. Boy, but was his boy able to get through looking like him? Clearly, like, no.
That's so, it's like,
what?
Yeah,
that's what I mean. That's
that's so funny.
There's what layers of like, so racism's going on
so
here.
Actually,
like, I don't know who's here.
Right before I came, a month before I came, I lost my passport.
Okay.
Cool.
And yeah, I had to apply for a new one, which costs like a good amount of money, and it's just like, it's just
not
trouble,
here,
you know, not compared to
like 80 bucks.
But like, you know how they say like, oh, is like all hijabis look the same, or like that's what we used to do. We used to use the same like cards from our friends to go through places, because a lot of people just think that, oh, all hijabis look the same, you know.
Oh, wow.
So I wonder if I could have not renewed my passport and used one of my friends.
If I did hear this story, first of all, the line is like, yo, UK is quite diverse.
But also, UK really interrogates, or they have interrogated.
Well, apparently, they didn't.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Like, I see here. Like, you're going to go. Like, whoa, buddy.
That's
odd, man. That's
I don't understand.
I just don't understand how it didn't work the other way around.
Yeah, right?
Like, if I was good enough to get through with my boy's face, how can my boy not? Like, is he better looking than me? Or is he like, you know, like, what's the deal? I'll just walk away feeling away. If I'm the guy left there in Prague.
Yeah, so he's left in Prague at the moment. He's
waiting for the FedEx.
Yeah.
What's that, DHL? What's your guys have here?
He has to wait for the embassy to get him an emergency UK travel document sent over. Normally it takes 2 working days to process, and it's going to cost him £100.
That's a trip. Aren't you guys all connected with the EU and everything? Isn't that just a train ride or something?
Oh,
like
no,
that?
that's ended on the 29th of March.
Yeah. I know, yeah. I can get like, yo, what's going on? Yeah. Oh my god.
I would like to know as well.
I know.
Questions that need answers right now.
You know?
You ain't gonna do it.
To me, it doesn't make any sense. Like,
certain folk.
I mean, the bill was rejected, maybe a month ago, and they were supposed to, which took them 2 years to make.
Yep.
And now they had to re-collaborate this bill to be presented next month.
Mm.
It took them 2 years to make this bill. How they gonna reform it in 1 month to go forward and be accepted?
They just want that amount of time for them to figure. Like what I personally think is whatever. Any government is gonna be like, okay, we'll take care of this in a little bit. That means they're setting up all these other little things just to set it up. Like, oh, I'm gonna talk to this corporation, deal with that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna talk to this guy, deal with that. And like, no. It's never about because I think there's a consensus already made. You guys wanna for the reasons that I believe. Maybe that pushed together by a little bit, like, racist reason.
Yeah,
100%.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
Yeah.
And then, like, the side that wasn't, I guess, racist about it, maybe it was a lot more like, you know, you don't want to be taken over by corporations. That's at least as far as I see, right?
Yeah.
But Bali, you guys seem just bony in the wrong way.
I don't know, it just, it affects so much that...
Yeah.
It just feels like when it happened, in my mind, they mentioned Brexit was a thing, and we were like, what's Brexit? And then they were we're going to vote on this. But what is Brexit that we're voting on? Oh, okay, the votes had, people had it 50-50-ish, and it was more... What's more is that it was just the... what is it called? No, it's not... What's the election type? What's the type of election called?
A referendum.
It was just a referendum.
Yeah.
There was no legal binding on it. Mm. It was only when Article 51, I think it is, was implemented that it made it legally binding that we had to actually go forward and leave the EU. But they could have had the referendum as kind of a first thoughts for where the UK are, then have the conversation of what Brexit is and what it means for us to leave, then have another referendum. Then having another referendum makes sense because nothing's finalized, you know?
Yeah.
Like. But now it kind of feels like...
You're just like, nah, buddy. You're just like, okay, yo, bro, you just want to dip.
Yeah.
I'm seeing.
Exactly.
But, yo, if we get the chance to do that to America, hell yeah. He's just Canadians, bro. That's why. Because I know that I hear the new sort of talk being like, as like Europeans look at the UK, the same way Canada looks at America, you know? Which I don't really like, I don't see it. But obviously, that's what they're saying.
I mean, I don't know. What is the relationship between Canada and America?
They're They're friends.
Yeah, they're friends. And we look down on them all the time.
No, we don't, actually.
As an excuse for us to not get stuff done on our end.
We use them as a... We compare ourselves to America as if America is a good source to compare yourself to.
Yeah.
But the reason, exactly, the reason they do that is to make excuses to say that we are the better, politer version of America, which in fact is lies.
Yeah.
All the Canadian people I've met are nice.
We are nice, but in regards to the government and the way the system is set up, America is overt in their actions, in their racism, in their Islamophobia, etc. But Canada hides it under this guise of niceness
and diversity
and quotations diversity.
Yep, quotations.
When in reality,
progressive quotation liberal.
Yeah, they only use those key words to position themselves in a very specific way, while they are actually committing all of those acts the same, similarly to America. So it makes you question which one is worse. You know, when you're telling me you're one thing, but in reality, you are something else, or when I see what you are and I see right through you and I don't have to question what it is. You are showing me that you don't like me and I know you don't like me. You're not faking a smile in my face. And unfortunately in Canada, the people who've been suffering under that the most obviously is Indigenous people of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It is the Black people of Canada. It is the Muslim communities in Canada. And unfortunately, it's just
the white boy people last week.
Yeah.
And then that's easy anger for the deserves to pick up on.
Yeah.
And then boom, you got instant hate. Easy bake.
Yeah, it's hidden.
Yeah, it's hidden, but
it's obvious.
They're keeping it.
It's just funny. Yeah.
It's obviously beat.
Did you guys hear about Shamima Begum? She went over to Syria when she was 14 or 15, and she's back over here now at 19, wanting to come back to the UK. But she went over to Syria to marry someone from an ISIS member. And she had two children over there in Syria that both died, and now she has another child that she wants to bring back with her into the UK, but the Home Office has revoked her British citizenship, so she will not be allowed to return back to the UK, and if she tries, she'll be charged and arrested.
Yeah. I hadn't heard about this specifically.
Yeah. I saw it for the first time on Saturday or Sunday. One of my friends was showing me the story about it, and I was just like, wow, I've never seen this. But yeah,
that's tough.
What do you guys think on the issue? I feel like maybe the UK might have been divided on whether she should be allowed to come back into the UK or because I guess it's it's more of a terrorist thing, maybe, because of who she went over to Syria and who she married. Maybe she might have, I don't know, she might be involved in that world, or and she might bring it over to here. That might be a fear for British people. But then, if she was born here, shouldn't she be allowed to come back here to live, even though she did go away to Syria at a young age, or for whatever reason?
I think that
shouldn't she be allowed to come back now, maybe?
It goes down to mentality and like how, what was going on through her mind and her decisions for leaving, and what was shown, like, you know, like, you, someone would go that feels like that is something that is not only just okay, but it is something that, like, you know, that they're being called to do. You wouldn't do that unless you felt like a divine push.
Of course.
You know, and regardless of what, regardless of what sort of, like, you know, it's not right, it's not good, you know, the things going on there more horribly beat. That's like, oh, you made that choice. You made the choice to go there, and now you're gonna come back because it was wrong. You know? But how young was she?
She's 19 now.
How old was she then?
And
then these people are trying to talk them over, like, it's almost seemed like she getting lured.
I think,
you know?
She went over there when she was 15.
Yeah, like 15-year-old can't, you know, that's like,
yeah,
that's like
15,
being lured. Like, you know, someone luring you over the internet or something like that. That's something like that to me.
So she left in 2014. So she left the UK in 2014.
So then 14. I'm not too sure, man.
But again, it all comes back to you know, who looks British. Who holds that label, who holds that title. Who do we always associate terrorism with? And under what any circumstance or excuse can we again have the face of another Muslim woman, visible Muslim woman, on the papers again under a controversy, you know? And that in itself is how Islamophobia or any type of discrimination that's turned into an industry continues to snowball into a bigger thing. So I feel like any excuse that the industry can get to put the face of another Muslim woman on the papers that circulate all around to create under a controversy is a benefit to them. And ultimately, who gets to hold on to that title of what is English or what is British? And
I mean, there's nothing English in this world. There's nothing, no such thing as English, because
it's a culture
England,
of colonialism.
Exactly.
And as a Canadian, or actually, one thing I will say, as someone from Canada, I don't consider myself Canadian. I say this all the time, because I don't believe that exists. First of all, we are in Canada. We are settlers on occupied land, on Indigenous land. And the Indigenous population of Canada still exists in the margins and peripheries of the system. They've been put there very intentionally for very specific purposes, and they're still struggling to maintain their livelihoods in a lot of ways. The number one population in the Canadian prison system is Indigenous people. There's thousands of missing and murdered Indigenous women who the police have not even looked into their cases because they don't value those lives. And it's a question of, how am I, someone who came from wherever, how can I call myself Canadian when what really does that term even mean? You know, and how am I constantly fighting the continuous colonialism that the state is trying to perpetuate and keep alive? And it is a culture of colonialism, and it continues to take. And even the diversity right now that Canada specifically prides itself on is a mixture of all these cultures that they actually don't like. you know, in reality. They like our food. They like that they can now call themselves diverse, but the ways in which people are treated and cared for is very obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was thinking, I was going to click on the next article, but then it just made me think about something that I was talking about with my friend. He's from Mauritius, and he was saying that there's an area of Mauritius where it was mainly fishermen country and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So because Mauritius is one of the British colonies, the British kind of, there was a space where America wanted to build an airbase.
Oh, is that Diego Garcia, right?
Yeah, exactly. On the Mauritian land. And he was very corrupt as a leader. And he set up a deal, I think it was maybe 50 years or so, that the Americans could establish a base on the Mauritian soil. But then they were meant to leave after 50 years. And the Mauritian people that lived there, who were moved into kind of central Mauritius and stuff like that, they were told that after the 50 years or however long has gone over, they'll be able to move back to their land. So they've raised up their generations and generations in mainland Mauritius when they're just fishermen and stuff like that. So now it's coming up to the time where the contract's coming up to the end, but the Americans are saying, well, we don't want to move from our base. And kind of, I think the British have kind of got a few planes staying there as well. So it's kind of like the Mauritius people that used to live there are being told that because there used to be a British colony, they'll be given British passports and they can go over to the UK. But how does that help them when they were like, they're from Mauritius? They don't want to go to the UK. They want to live and die where they were born, you know?
It is displacing in a very specific manner, and immediately as soon as you said this, I remember Frantz Fanon, you know, speaking of leaving his country and coming to France, and upon then realizing that, oh, my skin color actually matters here, you know? So for the people of Mauritius, it's like, sure, you're giving them a British passport, but what are they going to experience upon coming to this land, you know? They don't know what's coming with it.
Exactly.
So you've taken what they know to be their part of their ancestry, part of their culture, part of their livelihood, and it's just the cycles in which these imperial powers continue to build on.
It's believing you know what's best for someone else because you don't think when you touch down or when like, all these colonies and nations touch down on indigenous lands, they're like, where's your titties, where's cities and towns, man? Like, oh, why does this not look exactly like back home? You must not have your stuff together. So we have everything going on better than what you know for yourself because it doesn't look like we
it's
know.
It's forced
that. Yeah, and like they assume their own superiority with it. And that gives them justification. Or what was it? I think it was a certain term, like the burden.
The
white man's burden.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And one thing I've learned specifically is the saying of treat others how you would like to be treated.
Yeah.
How actually you should treat people how they want to be treated. Mm-hmm. You should ask people and inquire about how they want to be treated. Because the way and that's what equity really is, you know? That's why equality and equity are so are different and very and our counterparts in a lot of ways, because equity is actually asking someone based on your needs, based on your nuances that have made you who you are, how do you want me to interact with you? Or and unfortunately that doesn't exist much in the world.
Yeah, it doesn't.
On a complete side note, I went to Mauritius for one day.
Ah!
Oh,
long story, but yeah. I was staying in La Reunion, which is an island near to Mauritius. Oh, okay. So it's always my dream to visit Mauritius. So I flew over a 20-minute flight, and very, very beautiful place. Yes. La Reunion is a very beautiful place as well. So if you get the chance, you should go.
So I want these images to load up because that's the whole point of it. But there was some sort of, like, I guess, racist posts that have been put outside of certain people's houses in white neighborhoods in Cambridgeshire.
Sorry. Whose houses?
White people's houses.
And then they're
in Cambridgeshire.
And they're what?
Offensive.
Offensive.
There, yeah.
Yeah.
Racist. Like, I don't know. That sounds like a...
So no, it's just that. It's just there's been signs like mass immigration is white genocide. Oh. Diversity means no white countries,
also, like,
cities.
Pro, it's pro white.
Oh, well,
messages.
Is that pro or?
Mass immigration is white genocide. That's
pro white. Yeah,
that's pro white.
Yeah, that sounds very alt right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alt right, all white.
Yeah, so then it's the other way. And then it's had, like, diversity means no white countries, cities, neighborhoods, or people.
So I'm going to be beige at the end of the day, buddy.
There's a fantastic book, which I always recommend people read, called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. H-A-I-D-T. I hope I pronounced his name correctly. And he constructs a moral typology looking at different anchors in a moral matrix. That are used to understand how different people, different communities, different societies view the world. And he talks about weird nations, so Western, educated, industrialized, rich, developed. I mean, it's an acronym, and we can explore in greater detail what it means to be educated, rich, etc. But just for the time being, use that as a shorthand. And how these nations tend to have a 2 or 3 point moral matrix, that focuses on care and fairness, liberty, things of this nature. But then many societies throughout the world, historically speaking, have a 6 point moral matrix that features those three anchors, but also moral points of authority, sanctity, and loyalty. And what happens is that group identity binds and blinds. So people are drawn together over certain ideas, morals, cultural commonalities, ethics, etc. But what happens is they develop a blind spot in which it's very hard for them to perceive the worldview of the other as something legit and grounded in something that's logical. So they just see it as something completely inherently morally wrong.
As the burden.
Yeah. So both liberals and conservatives are guilty of this blind spot. And it means that there can be an absence of empathy and understanding for the other who gets othered. Mm-hmm. And then when you start to other, you can start to easily dehumanize other people. That book for me was something that was just the magnitude of it for me in terms of helping to understand where people might be coming from, whose worldviews I completely disagree with. I might think are morally wrong, repugnant, reprehensible. They're actually, for these individuals, there is a logic to what they're doing. For them, this issue is grounded in their own personal ethics, even though to someone on the other side of the political spectrum, it might seem completely unethical. Mm-hmm. And I think in the West, in post-modernity, in the era we're in now, I think a lot of the clashes occur around the sanctity marker, shall we say, and a lot of that comes down to basically sexual politics. And not to go into too much depth now, but you know, people will just often look at the other side, the moral reprobates, how could they believe this? And that same side is looking at the other side in the same way. I always recommend this book. I'm not sure how that links back to the
It does.
I think something that might, something that might say, how can people believe this way, how can they think this way, isn't it so obvious that this idea, this notion is ridiculous, it's morally wrong, it's out of touch? Then it's like, well, yeah, there are explanations or reasons that people believe what they believe, however wrong it is, and maybe the way to get to people is to try and listen first and foremost and then try and show the better path, shall we say. I'm trying to think of individual examples in my own life. I can't really think of them, but there's a great line in the autobiography of Malcolm X where Elijah Muhammad is talking to Malcolm X about using the analogy of a glass of water.
Yes.
And he says, Malcolm, rather than showing people, you know, a dirty glass of water, show them like the clean glass of water. So if you think the lifestyle, the belief, the approach that someone has is morally wrong, reprehensible, rather than criticize them for it, we'll show them, well, I believe this is a better path to walk, and this is why. And you know, there's another maxim that people say that, you know, when you point your finger at people, you have three fingers pointed back.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to.
But that's the thing. It's like, how are folks speaking on genocide when Britain's whole, the British Empire was created from genocide. Yeah. That's what it is. So how dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you ever talk of immigration like that when you first of all created those instances, the reasons for
you brought us here.
Precisely. There's no right. So
we
it's like
happy.
it's purely a matter of racism, I would say. It's purely a matter of white supremacy, I would say. Mm. Which obviously like Brother Tommy said, comes from a very specific othering method and very specific ideology, but it's globally harmful.
I come from the background I have myself as, like, you know, a Christian before I converted and everything. We had that sense. It was a mixture, I believe, that we were able to, I was, and then my mom would teach me and all that stuff, that I would be able to be a part of this group and still look down on not just groups and not just the people within our own group, you know, and then have pity for them. So I believe it's like a mixture of pity to be a savior, to better myself, so I'm good enough for, like, you know, something else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like,
it's
double-edged sword.
Yeah, satisfying the guilt.
It's satisfying
attention.
The guilt,
yeah.
But never bringing justice. It's about giving, handing out enough food stamps almost, or like band-aids or whatever, like doing like, hey, I've done, like,
short-term solution.
Yeah, it's that guilt. And I believe it's the guilt because, like, honestly, I believe that, like if shit was flipped, if we're ever in a position in the future, and I think that's what the big fear is right now, that if this old white genocide is gonna happen. Buddy, that's because you did that first. And you're scared that if we have the numbers game, that we'll do that to you.
Yeah.
I can't say no.
That's exactly,
like, you know
how
what I mean,
looks.
And that's because, like, you know, but, like, we have to, and that's where, like, people are so scared of, like, that violence aspect, that militant aspect, and they try so hard to, like, remind us of the non-violent, like, liberal voices, like, throughout time, Martin Luther King, whatever, like any sort of pro, like, capitalist, like, guys, let's be cool about this, as we, you know, try to incrementally change the world sort of thing, instead of, like, yo, we're getting this, we're ending this, we're getting our justice, and we're moving on, right? And but in that, it just prolongs the problem, you know? Like, talking about things and having the community to talk about the meeting, to about diversifying, to, like, set up another meeting to talk about how we're not going to do this in a little bit, pushing. It's that constant of giving themselves time. That's what it is. They're giving themselves more and more time by talking about it, and then they're going to pat themselves on the back about talking about it.
Yeah.
You know? And say, we've solved it because we're talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, it ain't about talking about it now. Talking, you know, chat shit, get elected. But, like, you know, like, buddy, if you're not going to be the action.
Sounds like politics, that is.
Yeah, that's what it is. Politics is everything. You know? Politics is the religion of the non-believer. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's how they set up their moral life, and, you know, like, they move. You know, why I believe that this person's allowed to be married in such and such a way, and this person's not. Like, so, yo, politics isn't everything. You can't run away from it. You can't escape from it. You shouldn't. Because if you don't, I didn't vote because I don't think it's going to affect it. Well, guess what?
It does.
10 different bands over there who hate you voted.
Yeah.
And they know that shit's going to work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, yeah, at the end of the day, beat. So then you got to beat your drum and do something about it.
It's true.
I
mean, there's one more story, but I was just going to go on to talk to you guys about your creative art. So, Tommy, I'll start with you and your book.
My baby.
Beautiful
So, Medusa wore a weave.
Yeah.
Or In the absence of magic, where does the title come from?
So I'm going to link this back to our earlier discussion about astrophysics.
Okay.
And as I was saying then, for me, at the stage of life I'm in, my magic exists in astrophysics. For me, that's the sole remaining area of my life where there is a magic, a mystery, something unfathomable that I can't possibly comprehend. Every other domain of my existence or realm, I've sort of seen the grit behind the glitz, the science behind the art, so to speak, which on one level can be liberating, on another level it can be limiting. Mm-hmm. So you understand how systems work, how people, I can't claim to be the transcendent observer who knows everything, far from it, but I've started to see how things work. And like I say, I'm a great believer in work ethic trumping talent. And it's funny because I was reading, you know, an article again today, especially it was talking about how in certain countries there might be the myth or the narrative of genius or prodigious talent that prevails over work ethic. So it links back to that, basically, in terms of my personal search to find magic in the world at this stage of my life. So as a child, you have that sense of wonder, imagination, being beguiled by what's out there. For me, that's gone. With maturity, which means I'm probably a bigger, better, faster, stronger, more capable adult who is adulting. But it means I, deep down, I long for that childlike. I think there's a Kanye lyric where he says, "A childlike creativity." I can't remember it. It will come back to me. But yeah, I'm still yearning for that childlike sense of wonder and magic, that utopic impulse. And really, it's about my search, my quest for that. And I utilize the image of Medusa wearing a weave as a exemplar of that. So that actually came from a line in the poem Medusa Wore a Weave. So with that poem, I just wanted to fit in as many metaphors and images pertaining to horror, the gothic, macabre, scary flicks as possible. So if you look at that poem, I'll bring it up now. There's all sorts of motifs from horror films, whether it's, let me see. I'm struggling to find, I should know that off my head. So yeah, we've got like Beowulf, werewolves, demons, angels, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, sirens, etc., etc. And so I had the line where I talk about terrifying visions, had a scared stiff, don't despair for nightmares, stare down the Blair Witch. So originally that's a reference to a 2004 BBC series called The Power of Nightmares by Adam Curtis, who's a really innovative filmmaker who makes very politicized films in a very innovative method whereby he takes a lot of archival footage and juxtaposes that with interviews with key players from political history. And then he has himself narrating events in a very distinct voice. His most recent work is a piece called Bitter Lake, which is about a 2-hour film. Watch that. But yeah, The Power of Nightmares was something that I referenced in this poem that I changed the line up a bit. So instead of saying, The Power of Nightmares, switched to Don't Despair from Nightmares, Stare Down the Blair Witch. So first and foremost, it actually came from the need to rhyme a couplet or have that multi-syllable rhyme scheme. So I'm like, linking it to lines before I had, you know, Goliath system, terrifying visions, tyrants listen, etc. And then so the line went from terrifying visions, had a scared stiff. I'm like, man, what can I rhyme with scared stiff? And I was like, Blair Witch rhymes with scared stiff. So first of all, it was purely utilitarian. It was necessity. I need a 3-syllable rhyme scheme that rhymes with scared stiff. Blair Witch. And then I'm like, hair hissed links to Blair Witch, Gorgon, Medusa. So then I was like, the Gorgon's hair hissed, Medusa wore a weave. And now I've got the wore a weave, three-syllable rhyme scheme now. So I'm like, what works with that? Sorcery. So then, spoke on the water, 21st century sorcery, composed in source code, encrypted for security. So there's a lot of alliteration, sibilance, internal rhyme, etc. So first and foremost, that title comes from a line in the poem, but that line really exemplifies this whole notion of illusion and reality, magic, mystery, technology, the organic world, etc. And I was just like, it's such a like vivid image Medusa wore a weave, because the very thing that we're most terrified of isn't real. And fear is something that holds us back as human beings immensely. And I speak, you know, from a personal level, as a child, I was quite shy, nervous, apprehensive. And for me, what gave me my confidence was rapping. That for me really was like a steroid injection. I got my self-esteem, my confidence, my swag from rapping. And there was a point where I quit rapping. So I had this calamitous fall and I had to pick myself up again. As literally, you know, I died before my die, to quote the spirit. I died before I died, to quote, you know, a certain spiritual tradition, to be reborn, but in a present sense. So I just had this notion of Medusa wore a weave. It's just a really powerful image. And the whole book deals with that notion of illusion and reality, truth and falsehood. So, yeah, it was a convenient, visceral, vivid shorthand for the entire content and premise of the book. And whenever I told anyone the title of the letter, just like, that title is mad. Yeah. Like every single person, I was like, yo, that's crazy. Like, and linking it to the cover art now, yes. And I think we might have a connection here.
Let me, I want to hear yours.
Yeah, I actually, there was a Canadian artist, a Somali Canadian artist whose name escapes me. That might be her.
She's one of my friends.
Yeah. There you go. And she has this image on her page of a woman. I think her face is like blue and literally her hair is on fire. And I think it's like a starscape behind her. And I was like, that's my book cover. And her art is reminiscent of a lot of this Afrofuturism art by another artist whose name escapes me, but it'll come back to me. So I was like, I want that as my cover. And I tried reaching out to her. I couldn't really connect with her. So I was there for about 4 months thinking, I need the image, I need the image, I need the image. I couldn't find the right thing. Anyway, I have a buddy called Zara Amoy, who's an amazing illustrator. And I first encountered her work in 2015, going to see The Last Poets perform in Brixton.
Yes.
And I saw a mural of hers. I was like, this art is sick. And I saw her Instagram handle and just followed her. And then we connected digitally as is.
As it goes.
Yeah. As is the case in 98% of all my, you know, relationships and connections these days. And yeah, just befriended her via, you know, via Instagram and whatnot, stayed in touch. And then literally 2017, it was like January, February. This time actually last year, 2018, sorry. And she hadn't posted in months, and then she posted this image, which is now the front cover. But I was like, that is the cover of my book, man. Like, I said, I was like, you had me at microphones and snakes. Like, and I actually, I used to have that same Shure microphone. I actually had that microphone myself. I actually won it in a rap battle. That's another story in itself. The actual original artwork was slightly different to what we have now. So originally the mirror just had her signature on, but I was like, yo, I want a black mirror with fire on it. That sort of reflects what's going on in my soul right now. So yeah, that's the sort of story behind it. In many ways, it's best to ask Zara what the rationale behind her art is, because it's her work that she, you know, kindly gave to me to use for my artwork. So there's her own thought process behind it that precedes my sort of using it with my work. So I was like, this is a, you know, a perfect fit for what I'm writing about. But I think if you look at her artwork, she has these really, really distinct collages, and there's a lot in this sort of style. So I'm turning the book into an album at the moment. So she's doing artwork for that as well. In terms of the interior art, that's by a designer called Abby Wright, who, again, I've known for a number of years, met her via Instagram. I actually interviewed her for a project I used to write for called Afropean. So again, for years we'd be saying we need to like collaborate together. So yeah, we hooked up, and it was, again, her idea to take the snake motif and use it as a thread throughout the book, which obviously the theme has her own very distinct illustrations in the book, and it creates a sort of linear continuity through it. So me and Abby worked on the design for about a year. Abby is an amazing designer, curator, art director. So my first degree was in visual communication, so I'm very much a graphic design guy myself. I mean, it's all Abby's handiwork, but it's very, hopefully not too annoying to her, but I was just very, you know, very particular about what I was like, can you change this? Can we include this? So, you know, I give you an example for the poem Heartbroken Mind Open, where it has this distinctive O shape.
Yes, I was looking at that.
Yeah, actually, I sort of borrowed, I mean, as with all that, you know, it's inspired by something else. There's a friend of mine called Sheila Naughty, who's an amazing filmmaker, and I saw an interview with her, and it had a very distinctive layout on the on the page, where there was one letter, and the type, the fonts were sort of structured around it. So I was like, that would work for Heartbroken, Mine Open. So I was like, yo, Abby, like, I need you to make this O, and then have the you know, the footnotes in the middle, and then the right. So it's a very collaborative process, but the whole layout in terms of the splash pages, the quotes, that was all her vision. Then, you know, I just make suggestions and she'd apply it and be just so patient and kind. So yeah, I mean, it was just an honor working with both of the girls, man. They're utterly amazing boss ladies, amazing women. Yeah, it was just a big honor and privilege. So now, hopefully we're going to be doing a lot more stuff in the future, but please, please, please check out the work. Azara Amoy and Abby Wright, two of the most talented people you'll meet, and lovely people as well.
The only other question I have is, did the title for the book... Sorry, you said the title for the book came from a poem.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you already have the idea of writing a book before you wrote that poem?
Yeah, yes. That was one of the latter poems. I basically had a real burst of fecundity. I think I said the word correctly, but a very prolific period between 2016 to 2017, where I wrote the bulk of this collection, and in particular, a lot of the latter. So I split it into two sides, which is a nod to my musical background. Yeah. The set side B, so to speak, is a lot more complex, shall we say. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm interrupting.
Yeah, yeah, we'll come back to you. Don't worry, don't worry. I know your talent as an artist.
No,
you're sick.
No problem, no. Is that your book?
Yeah, yeah, my esteemed colleague's book.
Yes,
so.
Yes, yes, yes. Your poets?
Yeah, we have a local creative who's just asking us about our...
You've both done a...
And we've been...
Yeah, that's Tommy's book, and this is mine.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
So much. Thank you.
Yeah, go on. So you're asking about the...
Poetry. I love it. I love all this kind of thing. Gosh.
You can have that copy if you like.
No.
He wrote those like jokes.
Let me just write in there real
quick. I saw Mewson. I saw Mewson. No, he said, like, yeah, I wrote it cold.
I watched you roll it and I was like, he worked. This should be a joint.
What is this?
I got the pre-roll, sir.
Oh, it's a joke. Jumbly. Is it a village for the village?
Of course.
It's a village. But yeah, yo, like, all right. Been missing
all
the comments.
Sorry.
Yeah,
if I want to find you guys, I can find you on the internet. Yes.
Yeah, within the Matrix.
What's the name of the green situation, guys? Because I know Canada's mud. I live there.
And poetry is my other love.
I've just done a film last year called Cannabis is Illegal, comedy film.
Yeah,
that was fucking fun. But other than that, I mean, it's just become legally. What's it called? Medically.
It's one step towards
the step, you know.
But yo, be careful. You want to talk about legalization? Legalization. Yo, everyone's still shook when they're getting their treats. They can like.
Be good. Take care.
Guys, like, yo, man, here you go. I'm like, yo, bro, hold it down. I was like, bro, what? It's legal. I'm like, yeah.
Nah.
Right. Right. Sure, buddy. Yeah, you can't believe it. I've been too traumatized.
It's true. Yeah, so the bulk of the poems I wrote between 2016 to 2017 on my phone whilst traveling around Londinium. The oldest piece in here dates from 2013. Somebody I used to know, which was written on a bus in Morocco, going from Marrakesh to a seaside town, whose name I'll struggle to pronounce, I won't say it. So basically in writing, it was 5 years, and the actual art took about a year to do. So the last year of those 5 years, shall we say. So yeah, it's a process over time, but I settled on the title towards the end, which is when I wrote the title poem, so to speak. But I just felt it really encapsulated that whole struggle or grapple or dichotomy between those different realms of understanding that I was personally exploring in the book. So, yeah, man.
Since we're short for time, I'm going to quickly ask you questions about your book.
Yeah, of course.
So, what was slept under the Persian rug?
Yes.
What was slept under the Persian rug?
What was slept under the Persian rug? Yo, everything. So many parts of myself. A lot. There's a lot there. So the work in itself is the title was developed when I was around 17, maybe. That's when I thought of the title, and that's when I was like, I'm gonna do a book. And the book itself is a collection of pieces from when I was 12 to around 17 years old. And actually, I had the title, and the title was set. And my brother, who is the one who has helped me with the layout and has done the illustrations of the book, he was like, yo, what the hell kind of title is that? Like, it's too long, it's six words, what are you talking about? And so at that point, I started debating whether I actually want to keep the title. I went to Iran, and my aunt told me a story about how my uncle, who was martyred in the Iran-Iraq War, him and my father wove a rug together. And with the money from that rug, they purchased a few little things. One of them was a shirt. They had a little watch. And
starting on road after that. Jeez.
And basically, the shirt that my uncle is wearing and all the pictures that the family has to remember him by is the shirt that he bought with the money from that rug. You know, so I was like, okay, this title is going to stay, first of all, because that is my history, that is my family, that is such a big part of Iran and art in Iran as well. And the cover actually is, so the thread is continuous throughout the book that ties all of the illustrations together. So if you see, it's literally a thread from the cover.
Yeah, just pull up that.
It's literally a thread from the cover that runs throughout the entire book. And
it's like one line as well.
Exactly,
that's a mad thing.
Exactly, it's one line. And honestly, I gave the book to my brother in a document, and I was like, I'm not going to tell you what to do, what illustrations to do for what. I want you to read it, and I want you to interpret what it would be. And so this is really a community project. I've had so many people help me in the production of editing, in looking over, in giving me advice, and I definitely couldn't do it alone, and so much of it is based off of who I am as a Muslim Iranian woman having been born in Iran and having been raised in Canada, and all of the things that come with that, the nuances and all of the hidden, all of the parts that I felt the need to hide, or all of the experiences I had gone through and felt like that they were anomalies, where in reality, I know that a lot of us are facing the very same struggles and are struggling to figure out what part of us is real, you know, and what part of us is most protruded in how we present ourselves as well, and how the world sees us, and how those labels are actually, whether we like it or not, they are us. So how do we take ownership of those things? The book's been a long time coming, and it finally came after 5 years. And it took that long because I was in high school. I would take the laptop in history class and sit there and compile the book and compile the poems I had together, not listening to history class. And it was done around that very same year, end of high school, which was around 2015. So I guess it's been less than 5 years. But the reason why it took me so long to actually put it out into the world is because it's over 200 pages of myself. And that's a lot. That's a lot to release and to give into the hands of so many other people. And with being an artist, the self-doubts are really real. You know, this internal battles are really real. And the growth is also really real as a person. So it was a lot of internal battles, a lot of doubts, but also a lot of breakthroughs and a lot of growth. So this is also my baby. And honestly, even if no, I hope people can resonate with it. But even if no one does, I hope this can be kept as an archive of myself into the world, into the future, especially for my kids. who hopefully will come in the future. This is for them, and
for a royalty check.
So buy the book. yes.
Come Amazon. Come
through. Yeah, it's on Amazon, and
kind of a lot cheaper for you guys over here, you know. Yeah. 25 bucks Canadian, what's that?
Yeah,
cut 25 and a half.
Yeah.
1275?
Jeez.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah, 200 pages.
Check it out.
Dropping 40 bucks for
40
pages.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, we're being kicked out.
Rightfully so.
It's been fun.
It has been fun. So thank you
so
very
much
for
thank
being
you.
On the show, guys.
Thanks for having
appreciate
us.
It.
And thank you very much, everybody at home, for listening.
Hey.
If you enjoyed it, thank you. If you haven't, more for you. For sat at home for an hour and 20 minutes, you're a numpty.
With that like and subscribe button?
Yeah, of course. Like, subscribe,
do
follow.
That. Got you. You got
it. Anyone have anything to plug quickly before we go?
What was swept under the Persian rug?
Medusa wore a weave or in the absence of magic by Tommy Evans. Yes.
Cool. Anyway, goodbye,
guys.
Much
love.
Au revoir.
Peace.
Dano.
Thank you.